Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best you can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 15 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Man, it is great to be back recording. We've been off a couple of weeks for vacations. We've been out of town. And so it's great to be back and getting back to some of these important topics that we like to talk about.
It is. Yep.
And especially today, the day after 4th of July. So we're on the 5th of July.
That's right. This is the 5th of July, which really should be July 2nd.
Right.
Since the Declaration of Independence was really signed on July 2nd. The Founding Fathers wanted July 2nd to be Independence Day, but for some reason it was dated July 4th. A little known fact about the Declaration of Independence. This announcement is brought to you by
History R Us. So another reason why it's great to be recording today is the day that the Women's World Cup final is being played, and the U.S. is playing against Japan in a rerun of last time's final, and hopefully this time we'll come out on top and reclaim our position as the world champs.
And we happened to be at a beach yesterday where there were a number of folks from England.
Yes.
And they're still talking about the unfortunate mishap in the England versus Japan semifinal.
One day we will do a podcast on sports psychology, because you know my love of sports psychology.
Right.
I felt horrible for that player. For those of you who didn't have a chance to see it, they were running back, and one of the England defenders was attempting to clear the ball. And she tipped it, a beautiful shot, just over her keeper's head and against the underside of the crossbar and into the goal.
Right.
An own goal in the 92nd minute to allow Japan to head to the finals.
Yeah, well, our English brethren are still talking about it yesterday. So,
well, the consolation was that England won third place yesterday
by
beating Germany for the first time ever.
Really?
First time ever.
Oh. So Germany's had a rough go of it this year.
They seem to, well, here we are with soccer talk, but they changed their style of play midway through this tournament. I don't know what happened to them. I had them as heavy favorites this season, this year, but they changed their style of play for some reason and turned ugly.
Hasn't worked out so well.
No, not at all.
Okay.
But hopefully the game this evening will be glorious for the United States.
United States versus Japan?
I've already got
mine. And you have your FIFA World Cup USA shirt on.
Yes, I do. Go USA.
Okay.
So what are we going to do today?
We're going to get refocused on ADHD, appropriately enough.
We are. We have received several emails over the past few weeks, and so we're going to get into those. I guess some folks have been listening to our last few episodes where we were spending a lot of time talking about ADHD, and so we have some great emails that bring us into some points that we touched on in our previous podcast, but maybe didn't go into in as much detail as we could have. So I'm excited for this.
Yep, good questions. So people have been listening to these podcasts on earlier podcasts about ADHD that we've done on medical treatments and non-medical treatments, and several people have asked what I think are really important questions about this disorder and its treatment. So I'm looking forward to talking about these issues this morning.
That's great. So, well, let's just jump right in to this first email. Looks like it's from Sarah. It says, "Dear Drs. Richard and Bernie, I just listened to your podcast on medications for ADHD. You mentioned that the sustained release medications last 12 hours. Many of them do. However, I noticed that when my 10-year-old daughter returns home from school at 3 o'clock, that she seems to be very active and she is unable to concentrate on homework. is it possible that her medication is wearing off in 9 hours rather than 12? Well, thanks, Sarah, for that email. That brings up many important points that I think we should touch on as it relates to medication and individual responses. The first thing is that, and we're going to get into issues like rebound and metabolic rates and stuff like that, but probably the most important thing is to remember is that, you know, any medication that you take, the amount of time that it's proposed or printed that the medication should last really is from aggregated data. When they study these medications and look at how these medications work, they kind of look at, they don't look at individual people. They take all of the data and collapse it together and look at what the typical rates are. So for many of these medications that, you know, are purported to last 10 to 12 hours, there are people who, you know, I've certainly met patients where they last 6 or 7 hours, mm-hmm. But I've also met people who take it at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning, and at 10 o'clock at night, they're still having a hard time settling to go to sleep because the stimulant effect is still high for them. So there is quite a range just because of our biology that will affect the length of time the medication is beneficial and active in our body. What's printed on the labels and in the PDR is really just an estimate. Mm-hmm. So that's one point. And so, yes, your daughter may have a very high metabolism and she's just burning through it pretty quick.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other issue is rebound. Mm-hmm. Richard, you were telling me this morning about a paper you read that addressed that specifically.
Right. Yeah, Larry Silver is a pediatrician who has been writing about the treatment of ADHD and learning disabilities for probably 30 or more years now. And every couple of years, the American Academy of Pediatrics asks him to address issues related to ADHD, treatment of ADHD. And in his most recent posting, he talked about this phenomenon called the rebound effect, which is that some children, when the medication begins to wear off, some children really begin to act out. And it's now called the rebound effect. They're rebounding from the absence of medication. And this can hit mid-afternoon or during that nuclear hour between 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock in the day.
And it's not just an increase in activity or anything like that. Sometimes, especially we saw this with a lot of patients with Adderall, right. They become very emotional.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would be very tearful. They would be almost emotionally dysregulated during that period of time for a few hours after the medication wore off.
It's very hard for them to regulate their emotions during this period.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right. And so so that is a very real phenomenon. And I like what he said that if go ahead.
Yeah, I was surprised that he said this, but he wrote in the article that if your pediatrician or if the prescribing physician won't discuss this issue of rebound, that you ought to look for another physician because it is real and it needs to be treated.
And I think that's fantastic advice.
Right. And typically they're not that bold in making those statements.
Right.
But he was in this case. So this whole issue of when medication wears off and how your child responds to that is a real issue and a very important issue.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because and a lot of that is, of course, outside of the child's immediate control. Mm-hmm. When you take a medication that you're supposed to take with food and you take it without food, you end up with an upset stomach and mm-hmm. you don't feel very well. Well, that's not a decision you're making. That's the medication's effect on your body. This is the same type of thing. This is an effect on the body from the medication, mm-hmm. Or in this case, the wearing off of the medication. Right. And so we have to be careful as parents not to be overly punitive during this time and sort of understand that the child is going through this difficult period. And we need to organize our lives in such a way that we address this rebound.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. It's another one of those times when the child really can't help this. I mean, the medication is worn off and their body is readjusting,
right.
is adjusting now to not being on medication. And those transitions can be very difficult for kids. But again, it's not their fault.
Right.
And so the first thing we have to do is we have to organize our lives to accommodate to this change, rather than punishing the child for acting out or becoming emotional.
Right, right. So some recommendations for that period of time. And we've talked about this before, and it really includes just tightening up the organization and the structure in the house during those times.
Right.
Triggers, Sarah, you probably noticed that some of the triggers during those times of your daughter's behavior is going to be transitionary periods where, okay, we got to change from this to this, or we got to move from this to this. And she's trying to adjust and you may be pushing for homework. Oh, no, you got to sit down and to get your homework done, sit at the table. And, you may be sort of pushing her to try to get her to do these things. You know, Sarah, you're probably doing it from the right frame of mind, thinking,
right.
Okay, the medication is going to wear off in a few hours. We need to hurry up and get your homework done before your medication's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so your heart's in the right place,
right.
But because of the way her body's responding to it, you may need to adjust those times a little bit and allow her that opportunity to transition through that phase, and then get to the other work that you need her to do at a different time.
Right. Yeah, you really bring up a good point there, because there are nights when, especially kids who are busy with extracurricular activities, they may have a ball game, a dance recital, a music. There may be something going on later that evening, and so the parents are saying, "Well, let's get homework done now,
right.
So that it's finished, so that you don't have to stay up late." The intentions are good, but when you push the child to get homework done during this period of heightened arousal, mm-hmm. or depression, or whatever emotional state the child's in, you're really pushing against each other, and you can create some problems. So you got to be sensitive to this on those nights.
Absolutely. And some other alternative ways in which parents do this. I have one parent that I work with who the child just cannot, by the time the parents get home to be able to help him with his homework, the child just is not available cognitively, mm-hmm. emotionally, to be able to do homework. And so what they do instead of getting up at 7 o'clock to get ready for school, they'll get up at 6:30 and they get ready and give the child the medication. And so by 7 o'clock, the medication is on board and they do homework in the morning. And that sort of gives the child the opportunity to get the homework done while the medication is working without the fight in the evening, and can still manage everything throughout the rest of the day. Now certainly that only works when you have an elementary school amount of homework. I mean, that's
right.
Not going to really work for high school chemistry, because
right.
your homework is going to be a little bit more demanding than that.
Mm-hmm.
But especially with some of our elementary school kids, and Sarah, you said your daughter was 10 years old. That may be a viable option,
mm-hmm.
Especially if homework is, or for if mornings go relatively well. And we know
right.
that a lot of ADHD kids do get up early,
mm-hmm.
and so that may be a way to balance that.
Right. Right.
So there's a few options. I think that it's I think that you have to work with what you have with your child. You know. Again, going by what the physician says you should see, or going by what the label says as it relates to how long the medication should last, we have to be a little bit careful for that. The other thing to watch out for, and this just jumped in my mind to mention, is that sometimes when you talk to your physician about this, you mention to your physician that you need to... That about this rebound effect, the physician is going to talk about adding another medicine.
Right.
And those medicines are going to be, there'll be different kinds of those medicines. So, for example, one physician may and give you the extended release for in the morning, and then in the afternoon give you an immediate release medication. So let's say that your child is prescribed Concerta during the day. So if you give it to her at 7 o'clock in the morning, but if it's only lasting until about 3 o'clock or so, the physician may add sort of the classic 3 or 4 hour dose of Ritalin. Mm-hmm. to supplement
right.
and to get you through those evening hours.
That really is an important question, because what many parents, it's not just parents, what we forget is that these medications, these time-release medications, are designed to last through the school day. But remember that children are coming home with homework.
Right.
And by 3 or 4 o'clock, if they're off medication, now you have a child with untreated ADHD.
Absolutely.
Trying to do homework. And that's why children with ADHD struggle with parents. The kids struggle with their parents over homework, because now you have untreated ADHD and you're trying to get the child to focus on homework.
Right.
So adding that afternoon dose, the child is able to focus and concentrate long enough to get the homework finished, but it's not so large a dose that it interferes with sleep.
Right.
So the child's still ready to go to bed by 8:30 or 9 o'clock.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
So that afternoon dose can be a very important solution to this very real dilemma that you face in the late afternoon and early evening hours.
Right, and that's usually the remedy that you would see if the medication is wearing off around 3, maybe 4 o'clock.
Right.
If it's later than that, if this rebound effect is happening at 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, which is very likely, you usually see the physician prescribing a different kind of medication. And these are usually our medications like clonidine, 10X, guanfacine, those kinds of medications that are really blood pressure medications by design, but they work in low doses. They work very well at sort of calming the child down and taking care of some of those emotional behavioral agitation.
Right.
And in fact, you know, there's lots of patients with ADHD who are only on clonidine
and 10X.
10X is the generic name is guanfacine. That's Intuniv.
Mm-hmm.
And Intuniv is another medication that's used by itself sometimes for ADHD. We talked about that in our in the ADHD medication podcast. You'll see some differences in what medications are prescribed depending on when the medication is wearing off.
And again, knowing your child is the most important part of this, because in the case that you just mentioned where the child seems to be going through the rebound at 6:30 or 7, for that child, it's really a good idea to do homework as soon as they get home from
Absolutely.
School. Because now you know the medication is still working. That's the good homework time. Then if things fall apart by 6 o'clock, the homework is finished, and you can deal with whatever issues arise after that.
Right.
So it really is, you really have to track this carefully and get to know your child and when your child is going through this rebound effect.
Right.
Good point.
Absolutely. And this isn't directly related to Sarah's question, but I'm going to throw this in there anyways because I think it's important, because we have this discussion with patients all the time as it relates to when kids should do homework. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Richard, you're absolutely right. It's imperative that you monitor your child. Lots of times we'll ask parents to keep a journal. Just look at the times at which these different things happen. And one of the things that parents bring as concerns is that we will say things like, okay, if your daughter or son is coming off of the medication around 6:30 or so, 6 or 6:30, you should have them do homework right after school.
Right.
The major concern is, well, I don't get home from work until 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and that's when we do dinner, and that's when we, and then we do homework after that. And that's a very real world problem. And what I encourage parents to do in those kinds of situations is, especially with elementary school kids who are oftentimes in after school care, Be diligent to find those after-school programs who have the children sit down and do their homework first.
That's right.
It's those programs are wonderful because what they do is that they make the child sit down and do their homework before they're allowed any of the free time stuff that they want to do. And so you have sort of a built-in reward system for them to get their homework done right away. The teachers or the care workers can look at it and make sure that it's all done. They may not check for accuracy, but they'll check to make sure that it's all done before the child then goes and does the playtime and the fun stuff. And that way the homework and everything is done before they get home, and then you can enjoy your evening with the child homework free.
Right, right. And that's another good point is you should allow some time to enjoy your time with your child, even if it's 20 minutes.
Right.
You know, Russ Barkley advocates just 20 minutes a day of pleasurable activity. Downtime with your kid is really, really helpful.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a lot of articles. For those of you who have been following us on Twitter, the handle is at Dr. Bernie, or on Facebook. We have lots of Facebook pages. The Mental Breakdown, Psychological Associates of Central Florida, that's our practice, or thementalbreakdown.com. We've been posting a lot of articles recently about the effects of overscheduling. Mm-hmm. You know, when our kids are so overscheduled, that's one of the things I think that leads to some of this rebound effect. You have these kids who are under all these demands throughout the day, and then as they're coming off of their medication, the demands don't lighten up at all, and it leads to some dysregulation and some other problems. So those are some things to consider.
Get to know your child and your family schedule. You know, every family has a rhythm and a schedule, and you know you have to fit all this into your family's rhythm. But for a child with ADHD, overscheduling is a very important problem.
Right,
and it's something you need to think long and hard about. You know, in terms of the number of activities, extra activities, how you're going to spend afternoon and evening hours,
right.
And that all has to be factored into these decisions with children with ADHD because some of them simply can't do it.
Right, and I like that 20 minutes a day of just stress-free time to go for a walk, just do something together that's not demanding for either of you.
Right.
That's great. Mm-hmm. All right. Hope that helps, Sarah. All right, let's go to the next one. This one is from Jackie. And this one says, Dear Doctors Richard and Bernie, you mentioned adult-onset ADHD, but said that you would talk about it at a later time. I think that was in our first podcast about ADHD, and we never did get to it, did we? I am a graduate student and finding myself having difficulty focusing in my long classes and for the hours needed to study. Could this be adult-onset ADHD? Thanks, Jackie, for reminding us to talk about this very important and timely situation, because we hear more and more and more and more and more and more about adult onset ADHD. And so let's try to clear this up a little bit. The first thing is let's talk about the diagnosis of ADHD itself. We went through that in the first episode on ADHD, and it makes it very clear, at least in my mind. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is what the American Psychiatric Association published as sort of our diagnostic Bible, symptoms of ADHD must be present before the age of 12 for the diagnosis to be made. That means that there is no real such thing as adult onset.
I've been sitting here thinking, I want to say there is no such thing.
Right.
But we want to be very careful about what we mean when we say there is no such thing as adult onset ADHD.
Correct.
Okay, but then let's explain what we mean by that.
Right. So diagnostically, what it tells us is that the symptoms have to be present before the age of 12. That does not mean that the diagnosis has to happen before the age of 12.
Right.
It just means that some symptoms have to be present before the age of 12.
Because
This is considered a neurodevelopmental disorder.
Correct.
Probably present at birth.
Correct.
But reveals itself over
right.
time. But it must reveal itself by age 12.
By age 12.
Okay.
Now, and that's better than what it used to be.
Right. It used to be
seven.
7 years old. Right.
In the DSM-4, symptoms had to be present before the age of seven, and now they increased that to 12. And they did that for a lot of reasons, I think, that have to do with the education system right. and that kind of stuff. But so when it comes to these diagnoses, the first thing that we do, if we have an adult that comes in complaining of symptoms that really do look like ADHD,
right.
the first thing that we do is we get a strong developmental history.
Right.
I've had 50-year-old patients come in complaining about ADHD mm-hmm. symptoms, and the first thing I ask them about is kindergarten and first grade. It's
right.
really hard for them to remember, but we need to go back in time and talk about what life was like in elementary school.
Right.
Now, do they always say that, oh yeah, I had difficulty sitting still, oh, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that? No, they don't always come right out with the classic obvious symptoms of ADHD, because, well, if they had those, they probably would have had the diagnosis when they were a child. But what we do here are things like impulsivity or distractibility or inattention, where they sat in the back of the room and didn't really pay attention. But how many times have you heard this, Richard? I could just sit there and not even pay attention, but if I just looked over the stuff real quick before the test, I would do okay.
Right.
Or I skated by with C's because I could mm-hmm. remember enough to get by.
Right.
Those are the types of symptoms that we see in people who may not have received a diagnosis when they were a child, but are certainly signs and symptoms that suggest the presence of ADHD. Maybe not an overly impairing set of symptoms, but symptoms that interfered with their overall functioning in general.
And the other thing we have to remember is that in a typical adult, even an adult in his or her 30s, you know, if they're coming in for the first time, say at age 35, they were in school 20 years ago, 15 years
right.
ago. And 20 years ago, if it wasn't the inattention and organization that schools were concerned, if you weren't misbehaving,
right.
you probably weren't getting referred
right.
to anybody.
Right.
So we mainly, in those years, you know, even in, you know, even 10 years ago, we were focused mainly on the hyperactivity and the
right.
poor impulse control.
Right.
If you sat there and couldn't keep yourself organized or didn't do your homework or something, that was a completely different issue.
Right.
Okay. So, unless you were displaying symptoms of hyperactivity, you were far less likely to get identified 15 or 20 years ago.
Right. Man, you're really making me want to get back and talk about some of those educational issues that we spent so much time talking about before.
No.
But we'll avoid that. Self-regulation. But that's all very, very true, because, you know, when people say, well, we didn't have these diagnoses, ADHD, quote unquote, mm-hmm. didn't exist when I was in school. Well, that's why. It's because, you know, those kids who were misbehaving weren't seen as ADHD. They were seen as problem kids.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And those who truly had the inattention and distractibility problems, those kids were grossly ignored.
Right. That's right. If they weren't causing problems, they were ignored.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, a C was acceptable.
Right.
You know,
right.
if they made a C, that was average, and so that
before
was
before the days of high-stakes testing
right.
and an accelerated curriculum and all that, these things were far less important than they are today.
Right, right. So that's the first piece of this to answer Jackie's question is, you know, no, there is no such thing as adult, quote unquote, adult onset ADHD. We have to go back and we have to look to see if there were symptoms and signs present before the age of 12.
Right.
That is not to say that adults, that the overt display of ADHD symptoms does not emerge in adulthood. That
right.
is a very real thing and right. can happen. You know, there's one particular group that this tends to happen with, and those intelligent, very smart people with ADHD who, you know, who tell us things like, you know, they could get through high school without doing anything and make A's and B's and have absolutely no, they probably don't have to study. They don't have to even read over the material. They can just sort of through osmosis, just absorb the information.
They're absorbing it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they do just fine. So their grades are just fine. They may get into a little bit of trouble, but, you know, they're nothing significant. But they're highly inattentive. They're highly distractible. But they manage. They manage
right.
well.
Because the challenges are not so great in high school.
Right.
To become evident.
Absolutely. Okay. Right. Absolutely. But as those folks enter college, and sometimes even graduate school
right.
that's when they really start to come out. Because now the demands exceed your innate capability.
Right.
And we start to see that all of those skills that you needed to develop during mm-hmm. high school and undergraduate,
right.
you didn't get those because you didn't need them at
right.
that time. And so now you're without the skills necessary to continue to be successful.
Right.
And now your ADHD symptoms are emerging.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's a very real phenomenon. I remember when I was working at the University of South Florida, I had the great opportunity to evaluate some of the students and people there just to help them out to improve their academic success. And I had a student come in one time, and it was actually a medical student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she came in and she goes, "Doc, I think I have ADHD." And I said, "Well, tell me why." And she says, "Well, I understand the biology."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "That's great." And she says, "And I understand that as I've been reading that, you know, stimulus and stimulating your brain helps you concentrate." And I said, "Okay." And she goes, "Well, this is how I have to stimulate my brain. If I want to study from one of my textbooks, I take my textbook with me to the gym. I prop it up on the treadmill and I have music playing in my headphones while I'm jogging on the treadmill, and there's a TV on in front of me.
Right.
With all of that stimulation, I can read and I can remember everything that I'm reading in my textbook."
Right.
Her brain needs a tremendous amount of stimulation so that she mm-hmm. can focus on what she needs to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, that's ADHD.
Right.
Now, she didn't have any problems before because she's a very right. smart
right.
woman.
Right.
And she did just fine in high school and undergraduate mm-hmm. and
all through college, she was able to handle it. Right.
Mm-hmm. But here she is in her first year of medical school, and the demands outweigh what she can do without the support of other
right.
resources.
Which is the point, that when environmental demands get to a certain level, then the symptoms really become obvious.
Right.
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 You aren't able to compensate. You were able to compensate before, but eventually we reach, whether it's medical school or law school or work,
right.
you know, the demands of work, you finally get to a point where now the symptoms start to become obvious.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm. So it's not that you just got the disorder. You always had it.
Right.
You just weren't aware of it because of the demands.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right. Another group that we tend to see this with are parents.
Right.
You know, first-time parents, and for many of the same reasons, when you're a parent, the demands on you are new. These are demands that you've never had before, unless perhaps you had younger siblings that you were responsible to help take care of. And so now you are in a situation where your time demands, your organizational skills, are important for not just yourself, but for other people as well.
That's right. When you're just taking care of yourself, the environmental demands are not that great. If your house is dirty, if the dishes aren't done, if you're a little bit disorganized, the behind in your bills, it really doesn't matter.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we see this with that population as well, that, you know, just as the demands of life in general,
mm-hmm.
Increase by the growth of a family or a relationship or anything like that, that's when we start to see some of these symptoms emerge.
Right. A parent must organize himself or herself differently.
Right.
And we know one of the problems with ADHD is difficulty keeping things organized.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden you introduce a baby or two into your life, and now you need organization. You have to organize your schedule. You have to organize
right.
your home. You have to organize the play dates. And that increases the demands on you, and suddenly again the symptoms of ADHD become obvious.
Right.
Well, so we have students and parents. Any other group affected this way? There's one that I can think of.
Go ahead.
Athletes.
Yes.
I think athletes run into the same thing. I used to do evaluations for Major League Baseball, their therapeutic use exemption policy. And invariably, many of them were pitchers. And they would say, when I was in high school, it didn't matter because I could throw hard enough that I just overwhelmed the batters. But now that I'm in the major leagues, there are demands that I didn't have because now they can hit a 95 mile an hour fastball.
Right.
And so I have to think differently. I have to concentrate. I have to think about the pitch count. I have to think about the batter. And all those increased demands, now they're aware that they can't think about all that stuff.
Right.
So again, it's the demands of the situation create circumstances that suddenly they become aware of their ADHD symptoms.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the underlying theme.
Right.
Is that in whatever area it is, whether it's athletics, academics, or
parenting.
Family, parenting, mm-hmm. when the demands placed upon you outweigh your ability to cope and to deal with innately.
Whether it's athletic ability or intellectual ability or organization,
right.
Whatever the ability is, when environmental demands outpace those innate abilities,
right.
Then you bump into the symptoms.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not, again, it's not that it suddenly emerges out of nowhere.
Right.
It's because they've always been there, and now you're not available mm-hmm. with the skills you need to cope with it and to deal with it.
Right.
ADHD does look different in adults.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see as much fidgetiness and hyperactivity. We see more inner restlessness and
mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things. Impulsivity
Impulse.
Sort of changes
mm-hmm.
a little bit, where we, instead of impulsively interrupting other people and doing those things, we impulsively buy things. Impulsive spending is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Impulsively jumping from relationship to relationship.
Right.
You
mm-hmm.
know, my main issue when I was in college was I every time I took a really interesting course, I changed majors.
Right.
I changed majors about 15 times in a couple of years of undergraduate, trying to figure out, because man, all those classes are
Everything
so interesting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that was a great sign mm-hmm. of my ADHD mm-hmm. behaving ridiculously.
Mm-hmm.
So ADHD does look different in adulthood. It does evolve over time. And, ADHD in an 8-year-old looks different than ADHD in a 15-year-old, and it looks different than an ADHD in a 25-year-old. So
mm-hmm.
We have to recognize that it changes. But for the actual diagnosis, we do have to go back and look to see about the presence of ADHD symptoms earlier in life.
Right.
That's not to say that always happens. Clearly, the phrase adult onset ADHD has gained wide popularity.
Mm-hmm.
I know physicians that use that phrase. I know physicians that treat adult, quote unquote, adult onset ADHD without really looking at the history. And just as is the case with children, ADHD symptoms can be present without the actual diagnosis as well. We can place you in a situation to make you look like you have ADHD,
mm-hmm.
whether you have it or not.
Right.
So a good diagnosis is really important, and it's imperative that we think back to those times. I love it when 25, 30-year-olds come in with concerns about ADHD, and I can still have access to their parents.
Right.
And I can find out what were they like when they were kids.
Frequently parents will roll their eyes or just start to laugh and talk about this kid, and very clearly the symptoms were there prior to age 12.
She wouldn't sit still for dinner.
Right. Wouldn't do his homework.
Yeah. So
now one question that does come up though, Jackie asked about treatment. Is the treatment the same?
She didn't, but we should talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same treatment as it is for children?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Stimulant medications are still mm-hmm. the primary medication used. And so that part is the same. teaching organizational skills. Right. I was meeting with an adult the other day with ADHD, and that's what our entire conversation was about. How do you organize your life? How do you, you know, set goals so that you feel like you're in more control, and working through the same types of strategies that we do with children and adolescents?
Because the best treatment is medication plus behavioral changes at home or at school. In adults, it would be at home and at work or graduate school. And so it's the same treatment, medication plus life changes.
Right.
And so much of the therapy is about what can you change in your life to overcome, compensate for the symptoms.
Right, because those additional skills are those skills that you didn't get because you didn't need them before.
You didn't have to develop them when you were younger.
Right, and so what we learned very quickly is that although we didn't need them before, we definitely need them now.
You didn't keep an agenda in school, but you better get a cell phone or something to keep track
of
your schedule today. Right, you better get a planner today.
So,
because life demands are going to require it.
Ever increasing. All right. I hope that helps, Jackie. You know, let us know if you have any other questions or anything like that. We have time. Yeah, we have time for one more.
One more.
All right. So this one is from John. This is Dear Drs. Bernie and Richard. My 9-year-old has been diagnosed with ADHD. Was diagnosed with ADHD, but has since been diagnosed with several other conditions, including a learning disability, bipolar disorder, and even Asperger's disorder. Mm. Is there a connection between ADHD and these other conditions, or was our physician simply playing trial and error? What is his real diagnosis?
What a great question.
Wow. Mm. We need a lot of time for this one.
Right.
Well, I think that let's fall back in time real quick. When Richard and I first met, it was in the, in 2002 or so. Mm-hmm. And we had the fortunate opportunity at the time to develop a relationship with some, physicians who were referring really challenging cases to us. Mm-hmm. These were cases where, medication didn't seem to be very effective. We weren't sure if it was parenting issues. We weren't sure what it is. And at that time, there was this explosion of diagnoses for early onset bipolar disorder. And so much of Richard and my early work was in the area of early onset bipolar disorder. And John, what we noticed was the exact pattern that you're talking about, where a child is diagnosed with ADHD, learning disabilities, bipolar disorder, Asperger's, anxiety, impulse control disorder. They go through these series of diagnoses, and what they found was that a lot of the treatments weren't very effective, and so as a treatment wasn't effective, the physician would change the diagnosis to something else, try a different treatment, and if that one didn't work, they would try another diagnosis. And in that way, it was very much like trial and error.
But typically, with these children, the first diagnosis that was made was ADHD.
Right.
We sort of had a running joke at the time that we said we should write a book and the title of it should be Everything Starts as ADHD.
Right.
Because it just seemed that at age 3 or 4, or more typically 5 or 6, the first diagnosis that somebody came up with was ADHD.
Right.
It might change after that.
Right.
But that was the first diagnosis.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so...
Now, wait a minute. Before we leave that, though, why? Why is it because of the symptoms?
It was because of the symptoms. And you know, the issue is, and we talk about this a lot, is that children experience, in our opinion, children experience many of the same behaviors, emotions, feelings, thoughts that we as adults experience. And the problem is that they don't have the repertoire of behaviors and vocabulary that we have as adults to be able to describe those things. And so the challenge and sometimes joy of working with children and adolescents is trying to figure out from within a limited set of behaviors what is actually going on. And so what we see in 5, 6, 7-year-olds looks like ADHD, it looks like inattention, looks like impulsivity. Right. And as their behavioral repertoire expands, then it starts to look like something else. Okay, well, now it looks like it's more irritability, and it looks more like socialization difficulties, or it looks more like learning difficulties. And so as the child has more experiences in school, more experiences with social relationships, more expansive emotional presentations, we will see the diagnosis change, because what we're really stuck with is making clinical diagnoses that are based upon presentation, behaviors, and reports.
Based on what we see.
Based upon what we see.
So that the young child, say the five-year-old, four-year-old child, a five-year-old has temper tantrums. Now, it's normal for a three-year-old to have a temper tantrum.
Right.
Not normal for a five-year-old.
Right.
So we say, well, that child looks like looks like ADHD because there's something developmentally inappropriate.
Right.
But then if that same temper tantrum occurs at age eight, now it doesn't look like ADHD. Now it's starting to look like the irritability that we associate with a mood disorder like bipolar disorder.
Right.
So you can have the same symptom, but at different ages, it conjures up a different diagnosis.
Right. And depending on how the questions are asked by the physician and how the parent presents it, you know, that temper tantrum at 8 years old, if it is presented as, well, if it's presented as something restricted to transitionary periods, and then the follow-up question is, how is he with his friends? Oh, well, he doesn't have too many friends. You're going to have a diagnosis of Asperger's or autistic spectrum disorder.
Right.
If it's related to, well, he does that when it's homework time, and anytime I ask him to read, then you may get into a diagnosis of learning disabilities.
Right.
If they come out of nowhere or seemingly come out of nowhere and are over very little provocation or sometimes unknown provocation, then you might get the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. So depending on how questions are asked and sometimes what has happened in the immediate history, you know, the diagnosis will change.
Right.
And so, John, I like your question about what is the relationship between these different diagnoses. And what we know is that there is some relationship between them.
Right.
We know.
Yeah, because they're symptoms. They're based on symptoms.
Right.
That are displayed at certain ages.
Absolutely.
Right.
And maybe even more importantly, symptoms at different ages, and our interpretation of the function of those behaviors.
Right.
Why did those behaviors occur? Mm-hmm. If it occurred because we can't handle changes to our routine, that's different than if they occur for no reason at all.
Right.
Or if they are just an impulsive reaction to something happening in the environment. Mm-hmm. Our interpretation, because oftentimes an 8-year-old can't tell us, or in John's case, a 9-year-old can't sometimes verbalize why these explosions or these outbursts are happening, we have to figure it out.
So it's really important as a first step to try to figure out what need that behavior is serving for that child.
Right.
You know, okay.
Right.
Now there's another issue here, I think, that is in this question. One is, What is the official diagnosis? John is asking, does my child have ADHD or Asperger's or bipolar disorder?
Right.
Isn't it possible that a person could have ADHD and another disorder?
Absolutely.
That whole issue of comorbidity.
Comorbidity, right. And that is the thing that another one of those challenges of working with children is that we find that comorbidity rates or the presence of two or more diagnoses at the same time is much higher in children than it is in adults. I think part of that is because our limited ability to assess and evaluate some of these behaviors. But we see a significant overlap in diagnostic criteria between especially ADHD and many other diagnoses, whether it's oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, bipolar disorder, learning disorders, Asperger's. The overlap in symptoms is great and could lead to a diagnosis of almost all of these things even at the same time.
Right.
And so it calls for a really thorough evaluation. And what I mean by a thorough evaluation is not necessarily a lot of testing, It means we need to meet and talk over a period of time to see how the behaviors are consistent and how they change so that we can then provide a more confident diagnosis and treatment plan. John, my guess would be that what accompanied those diagnostic changes were failed treatments.
Mm-hmm.
That was our experience, is that
right.
if we tried a stimulant medication and it made the kid more agitated, okay, we're going to change the diagnosis to something else.
Right.
And then we'll try another medication. And if that medication didn't work, then we would then change the diagnosis again. Or we wouldn't, but the physician would. So the problems with comorbidity is that it takes a lot of time to really tease these things apart to figure out what's happening. But let's talk about a couple of really, really important relationships, like ADHD and learning disabilities.
Right.
Well, children with untreated ADHD, what is it? I think the estimate is somewhere between 60 and 80% of kids with untreated ADHD look like they have a learning disability.
Right.
They're not paying attention. Their reading comprehension is very poor. They just do not do well in school. However, once they're treated...
Mm-hmm.
Once treatment is provided, the actual rate of learning disabilities in children with ADHD is about 30 to 50%. Okay, so
Correct. It's
almost cut in half. So when we're talking about this specific relationship or comorbidity of ADHD and learning disabilities, our treatment matters.
Mm-hmm.
When adequate treatment is provided, the actual rate of that comorbidity declines significantly. And what that means is it was never there to begin with. It was just there
because of the ADHD.
Right, because of the overlap in symptom presentation. Mm-hmm. Others are different. You know, in the past, with previous editions of the DSM, one could not be diagnosed with Asperger's and ADHD at the same time.
Right.
They were exclusionary. Mm-hmm. However, the symptoms overlap, in some cases, almost mirror each other perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look at how the relationship between those disorders affect the child. The biological presentation of ADHD and Asperger's are different.
Mm-hmm.
They work or they affect the brain in different ways. ADHD, again, is much more of a frontal lobe condition, whereas Asperger's and even autistic spectrum disorder seem to be lateralized to either the left side or the right side, depending on the child's presentation, because of the social problems and social implications that we see with those disorders and some of the rigidity in thoughts and behaviors. So,
but when you talk about comorbidity and you're moving in the right direction here, is that when you're trying to sort it out, kids with ADHD, what are the primary symptoms? Poor impulse control. Maybe they're a little bit active. They have trouble focusing. But they typically don't have social problems. They're typically very friendly, funny, gregarious.
Right.
They might be a pain in the neck. They might become a nuisance. But they don't have social skills deficits.
Right.
Whereas children with Asperger's disorder do.
Right.
Children with autism have social interaction and language deficits. Kids with ADHD don't.
Right.
I think the closest parallels between kids who are oppositional versus kids who have ADHD. And again, the child with ADHD is not consciously, purposely oppositional. They forget. They forget the rules. They act impulsively. But it's not specific oppositional behavior. So there are features of ADHD that can be used to separate it from these other disorders.
Right.
Okay. And that's what I think when you talk about making a careful diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
That's what we have to do, is we have to very, very carefully look at each symptom and say, what does this child have? Now, it's possible for a child to have ADHD and be oppositional.
Right.
You can have both disorders. Mm-hmm. But again, the diagnosis has to be done very carefully to sort all those symptoms out very carefully.
Right, right. It takes more than one visit.
Right. And it takes more than response to medication.
Right.
You know, frequently these diagnoses are made based on whether the child responds to medication or not. That's not a sufficient diagnostic workup.
Right.
We have to look at the symptoms, because all the medication is going to do is give you symptom relief anyway.
Right.
You still have to deal with all the underlying problems.
Right. Mm-hmm. And a similar differentiation can be done between ADHD and bipolar disorder, though it's a little bit more challenging. One of the main reasons that children receive these diagnoses is because of what they call explosive outbursts.
Right.
And it is not at all uncommon for kids with ADHD to have an explosive outburst.
Right.
Children with bipolar disorder, that is sort of a hallmark. We call it bipolar disorder back then, and we're calling it more disruptive mood dysregulation disorder now.
Right.
But that's the hallmark of that diagnosis. And so how do we differentiate between ADHD and disruptive mood dysregulation disorder or bipolar disorder? Well, the way that we always talked about it, and the way that we teach others to think about it, is the duration of the outburst.
Right.
For the ADHD kid, it's the flash in the pan. It's a firework. It hits. It's big. It's done. They're ready to move on and don't understand why you're still talking about it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
With bipolar disorder or disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, it is very, very different. Mm-hmm. Those outbursts last 30 minutes, an hour.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They go on and on and on.
They're more frequent and they're longer duration.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's much more of an emotional component to it.
They're hot. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We think of it as their brain is just on fire.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they hold grudges.
Right.
So, you know, it hits, it may take some time for them to recover. And then even when they recover, sometimes if you go back to try to address it and say, hey, let's talk about that outburst you had earlier, it happens all over again.
Right.
Whereas the kid with ADHD will say, my bad, I don't know what happened. Okay. Can I go play Xbox? So we have to really work hard to tease apart what the presentation is so that we can make the accurate diagnosis and more importantly, provide the appropriate treatment.
Yep. And I think this brings up that central issue of what a clinical for all of these disorders, these are clinical, we talk about clinical diagnosis. There is no lab test for any of these things.
Right.
There's no x-ray, there's no lab test. These are observations made by trained professionals. And sometimes it takes a little while to get to know the child well enough to know exactly what the problem is.
Right.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what we do in these kind of situations, our goal in these kinds of situations is to spend as much time as possible over multiple sessions to see what that presentation is. We do a lot of work with parents to give parents the skills necessary not only to manage the symptoms but to adequately evaluate the symptoms so that they are giving us good reports.
Right.
You know, there's nothing more challenging than when a parent comes in and they're just simply frustrated. And they're just saying all kinds of things,
right.
and none of it is really useful because it's all emotive and it's all just, I'm so frustrated, I don't know what to do, why can't he just stop, why doesn't he just listen? And while it's great to be able to come in and for them to vent in those ways, it's not really helpful as it relates to us actually making a diagnosis,
right.
Because it's just frustration.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that. We do lots of parent training in those kinds of situations. Another podcast perhaps for the future is talking about how the healthcare system affects all of this stuff. Because certainly if a person comes in and you come in for your initial visit and you're going to use insurance to pay for it, which you should, a diagnosis has to be made at the first visit.
Right.
For us in our office, a first visit lasts about an hour. But at some psychiatrist's office, the first visit lasts 20 or 30 minutes.
Right.
And a diagnosis has to be offered.
You have to code a diagnosis.
A lot of physicians, a lot of psychiatrists work from the perspective that, hey, if if you came to see me, you're wanting medication. And so after a 20 or 30 minute session, they got to make a diagnosis and they're going to give you a prescription. Mm-hmm. There's a few that are different. And most of those that are different don't take insurance.
Don't take insurance for that reason.
For that reason.
They don't have to make a diagnosis.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, the whole idea of how the insurance companies guide a lot of this stuff is it blows mm-hmm. my mind. You know, they dictate what we can and can't mm-hmm. diagnose. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of insurance companies that don't reimburse for therapy for ADHD. Mm-hmm. You know, not the medication part, they'll reimburse for some of the medications. But when it comes to actual therapy, working on the skills that the child is lacking, they won't cover that, even though research says that that's important. What's important.
Best practice. Yeah.
So, you know, those issues notwithstanding, when it comes to all of these different diagnoses, comorbidity is a major issue and really just takes time. And seeing somebody who's going to look at things thoroughly and talk to you in such a mm-hmm. way that an accurate diagnosis is made for you.
And I think that's the important message in John's question is, it could be a single diagnosis, but it might be more than one diagnosis.
Right.
It might be comorbidity. And the other thing about children, the difference between children and adults, is that a diagnosis can change over time as the child changes over time. It's going to look different at 8 than it did at 5, and it's going to look different at 12 than it did at 8.
Right.
So it is something that we have to look at very carefully over time. And rely on your description of the symptoms, because it's a diagnosis made by symptom presentation, not by lab test.
Right. Especially when a lot of the symptoms are in the school.
Right.
You know, how many times have we heard, you know, oh, he had a wonderful year last year, and this year he's just falling apart.
Right.
Well, I want to know what the differences are in the teachers.
Something different.
What did the teachers do differently last year that they're not doing this year that made such a big difference?
Right.
So there's so many questions to explore related to these diagnoses and everything. So, John, you got a lot of work to do, man.
But stay in touch.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Let us know.
Let us know how it goes. Look at that. We're at an hour and 1 minute.
There we are.
Perfect.
Okay.
Anything else for today?
That's it.
Thank you guys for sending in your questions, and keep them coming. We ask that if you have the opportunity to jump on iTunes and write us a review or do any ratings, that would be greatly appreciated. Kind of expands our ability to reach out to other people, lets other people know that we're here providing what we hope is useful information for everybody. As we've mentioned, you know, check us out on Facebook, on our blog, thementalbreakdown.com, Facebook. Is facebook.com/thementalbreakdown, and of course on Twitter at Dr. Bernie.
Right.
With that, we will say goodbye until next week. What do we want to talk about next week?
I was just thinking about that, and I don't know. We're going to have to go back to the drawing board and see what other issues are coming up. There's some medication issues floating around that we may want to talk about, but let's meet during the week and make a decision.
All right. We'll always be watching out for your emails, because if we get emails, we'll address those before anything else.
Right. That's what I would like to hear from our listeners and address their questions.
So until next week, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And have a great week, and go USA. Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.